My name is Jerioth Wakarema Mwaura. I'm the program lead for Youth Impact Labs, which is a youth employment program that is funded by Google.org and implemented by Mercy Corps in East Africa and Middle East. Here in East Africa, our approach is to work with innovators and to support innovators that are creating new work opportunities while leveraging technology. And we support them by providing grant funding, equity funding, and technical assistance to help them scale their platforms or the innovations that they have come up with. So far, I have been working with Mercy Corps for the last 2 years on this program. We've supported a total of 10 innovators in East Africa, ranging from agriculture supply chain solutions to MSME support solutions, digital commerce solutions, gig platforms, and across all those platforms, we have been able to create 1,500 work opportunities and impact over 10,000 beneficiaries through our support.
Okay. We'll start my interview to focus on four broad areas, the gig economy, Kenyan tech scene, digitization, and what you think about the future.
All right.
Briefly, would you take us what the gig economy report was about?
About 4 months ago, the gig economy platform report that was looking to help people understand the gig economy in Kenya, understanding the building blocks of the gig economy. We did this as a first of a series of gig work reports that we want to release as a youth employment program, where we want to share the lessons that we have learned and also what we know about the gig economy in Kenya. The report was focused on first laying the building blocks or the pillars of the gig economy, telling people about what are the growth drivers, who is driving the gig economy, who is innovating around the gig economy, who is supporting the innovation that we are seeing in the gig economy, but also to take a sober look at what is working and what challenges are being faced. We did so by interviewing innovators, interviewing investors and funders. We also interviewed employers. And finally did forums to interview gig workers. And all in all, took a very neutral standpoint in understanding what is working and what is not working, which we recorded in that report and also gave out a call to action on where we see more needs to be done. And that was specifically focused on where we see opportunities for funders and investors to support the growth of the gig economy, as well as employers to support the growth of the demand side.
Okay, and what do you feel is Mercy Corps's role in promoting the gig economy? Seeing that now Kenya, I think in terms of digitization and adoption of technology, in sub-Saharan Africa, we are ahead. I can't say we are among the top 10. Mm-hmm. How do you feel your organization is promoting this now? I mean, we are here, digitization is here. It's either we adopt or we are left behind. And I've told you, I've come with an Uber, which previously I would have gone, looked for a driver, car, let's go and negotiate the fare, but now the touch of my phone.
Yeah.
Someone is there, is employed, Uber is not Kenyan. How do you feel now your organization is helping to promote this, the gig economy?
As I mentioned, we are a youth employment program, and our approach is to support innovators that are developing solutions to youth employment. And one of the biggest opportunities to solve our youth employment opportunities is through gig work. Gig work has been the norm in the country, and there are a lot of people who identify themselves as gig workers, especially in the informal economy, but we are seeing increasingly technology being leveraged to expand that market. So far, we have supported four gig work platforms in East Africa. Specifically in Kenya, we supported two, one which is a ride-hailing app for border border riders, and one that is supporting fundis to connect to clients. And so our support to date has been providing funding and providing technical assistance to this platform. Now, having worked with these platforms for 2 years now, we are now taking a lead role in advocating for the gig workers. I believe that as a development community, we have to take the forefront in not just supporting and funding, but also in being that bridge between the workers, the platforms, and the policymakers, so that as this economy grows, it grows inclusively, it grows in creating good quality jobs that work and that are sustainable. We have been releasing a lot of thought leadership pieces in order to influence the direction in which the policy is going with regards to worker protection and with regards to the policies and models that innovators are coming up with, so that we can ensure that gig work is not just a low-income work opportunity for workers, but they are, as the innovators are coming up with these models, they're not pushing the workers' income down, but instead are creating a way to sustainably ensure that the workers get at least minimum wage and get opportunities to grow at their career paths while providing value to the clients.
Okay. You said that you've supported two in Kenya, mm-hmm. Red Hailing App and Foodies. Would you kindly name which channels are there?
Sure. So the Red Hailing app is called Get Border. When we met them, they already had developed an app that is connecting riders to clients. And they, specifically, their niche area is courier. So that is mostly supporting social media entrepreneurs as well as e-commerce entrepreneurs to make that connection to their end clients. When we supported them, we're supporting them to optimize the route so that one rider does not have to sit and spend the whole day only doing two or three trips, but in order to optimize and know there are three other people who are sending packages to that direction and bundle them up. That way they get an additional income and also making a channel of connection to e-commerce platforms that are doing most of the courier services to end clients. That way, a rider who would have otherwise only earned 500 shillings by transporting people back and forth is able to earn a lot more because of the optimization and coming and aggregating into a platform. And we have seen that what is needed in the gig work, as I said, gig work has been the norm for a long time. And if we're going to take it forward and make it a quality source of income for many people, there's need for people to be organized. If you are an individual rider, you might not be able to get jobs from big e-commerce platform. But if you are under a platform, then that creates digital trust, that creates easier payment as you're dealing on a B2B perspective. And that means more opportunities to increase income for existing riders. Our second partner is Link, LYNK, which is a platform that is building an infrastructure for foodies. And they have over 70 categories on their platform, including cleaners, plumbers, electricians, designers, all sorts of gig workers are on their platform. And what they provide is an infrastructure to first connect to the client, to be able to communicate professionally to the client, to get a payment gateways to ensure that the clients are pay their workers. But also in addition to that, they are providing access to loans and access to tools for these workers in order to help them get larger value jobs, but also in order to ensure that the client gets the best possible service. So for them, we are supporting them to ensure first they scale and get more workers on their platform, but also improve the quality of work. And they've been doing a lot of great work figuring out what kind of model works so that clients can pay a premium for the work that they're giving, with a guarantee that the workers that come to their houses are vetted, are good quality, and will deliver exactly what they say they will be able to do. And in that way, ensure that workers get consistent jobs on the platform, but also that they are paid, they are able to actually make minimum wage on the platform.
Okay. You've talked about the Fundi and the Boda Boda app. How do you think Get Boda is different from something like Safe Boda or the Uber Boda and what have you?
Yeah.
And how is Link, this one for Fundi, is different from Kuhasa? Have you heard of Kuhasa?
Mm-hmm.
How is it different? And what made Masikop decide that you will take get border to work with them and link. What led you to that, and how different are they from the rest? Because they are already in the market.
Exactly. Yes. Okay. I think with Safe Border, they do individuals, so they are transporting people, not packages. So the reason why when we went to look for platforms in the transport sector, we specifically wanted courier platforms, is because we know that the biggest employers in Kenya are the MSMEs. And so we're looking in all possible ways to find solutions to the constraints that micro and small enterprises are facing. And one of the ones that we had, especially from people who are trading, either they have a small shop in Nairobi or, you know, trading over a social media platform, connecting to their clients through WhatsApp, is that solution of how they will be able to get their goods to their final consumer is one of their biggest constraints. And so we wanted to find a solution that will not only create direct jobs, but also indirectly impact what we consider the biggest employer segment. And so that was the thinking behind why would we select, a safe border. With regards to Link, it is different from Kuhaso to the extent that Link is going for blue-collar workers. And by blue-collar, I mean it is the actual fundi. It is the actual carpenter or the plumber that is on their platform, as opposed to Kuhaso, where it's more of a, I don't want to say it's an online job, because it's a developer or a web designer that is on those platforms. But in our choice of Link, we do not compare Link to Kuhaso. But in our choice of Link, we are looking for a platform that shared our vision of trying to find a model that works for workers. So it is not just sharing the numbers and saying, I have 1,000 gig workers on the platform, but a true commitment to these gig workers in the sense of building that infrastructure to make sure that they get all they need to thrive in this gig economy. And that is everything, all the additional work that they are doing around training and tools and access to loans was very exciting for us, to want us to push them to create quality jobs, which I believe will create the standards for all other platforms that are coming into this space. You know, at a very bare minimum, you have to bring value to the workers.
Okay. Now coming to my second part of the interview is about the Kenyan tech scene. And I like that you have actually supported a Get Border and Link, which are Kenyan-born initiatives. Mm-hmm. What do you think are some of the challenges such apps or platforms are facing? Seeing, in this case, I want to assume, what if Masipo had not come on board? What do you think are some of the challenges those people are facing in terms of access to funds? Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a major challenge mm-hmm. for them?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's even unique to digital platforms.
Okay.
It's unique to all startups. It's the norm for all startups in Kenya and all startups in the world that fundraising is difficult. Because, you know, funders want to see traction before they can put the money in it. And where we see our role is we are willing to take the risk, and we are willing to put the early stage financing if we believe in the vision that you have in the company. And we believe that more development companies and more development organizations need to go in this direction, because there are a lot of great innovations in Kenya. There are a lot of great innovations to youth employment that have been released, but these innovators lack the critical initial early stage funding in order to expand them. And even beyond financing, so financing is a huge problem, but even much more than financing, I think the biggest problem that is facing digital technologies that are coming up is access to market. With every solution, it's just a great idea or it's just a product until it goes commercial, until people are willing to pay for that solution. And in order for even these innovators to go on and get additional funding, they need to show that several people have paid for that, for the service that they are giving. And that's a point where now we are supporting innovators to first find a way to very quickly pilot their innovations and find if there's a market for them, but also encouraging employers, especially in the corporate sector, but also individuals to just be those early stage market. So if you hear a great innovation has come, just try it out. It doesn't have to have a big brand name, but try it out, because that's how they learn, that's how they get the feedback to iterate and improve their innovations. But mostly that's how we support our own, because these solutions, especially in gig work, it's a two-sided market. You cannot take on additional gig workers on your platform unless there's a ready market that is willing to pay for the convenience. But we have seen a lot of growth in this sector, especially with access to market, with the emergence of Uber. Initially, Uber did not have very many clients, but now everybody is comfortable getting an Uber. And so there's a lot of digital barriers that have been broken. And now, you know, the path is really great for a lot of digital innovators to come in. I know first people are willing to take on digital solutions. People are willing to download your app. People are willing to pay a premium for convenience. So that has been proven. It's about now time for innovators, especially Kenyan innovators, to take advantage of the progress that we have made in our digital space in order to come up with better solutions.
Okay, I want to concentrate so much on the access to funds. I was talking to a thought leader in the Kenyan tech scene.
Yeah.
And he told me what we need to do to develop our own domestic funding and domestic venture capital is we need to rethink about things like grants and donor funds. And I'm happy that Masiko is actually leading that change.
Yeah.
How do you feel you need to make donor funds to be accessible to startups?
Yeah.
Rather than, because we want to think maybe what donors do, they come, initiate a project in the community, maybe let's say something like water. They initiate, then they leave us there. But the project is not growing in a way that it will incorporate now more people as we move, because the platform, I think, like this link, the more it's growing, the more it's accommodating more, but the more we are getting more people from. How do we think about these donor funds and grants to be more economically viable to fund such now startups and the gig economy.
And I think a lot of donor organizations are already thinking that way, in the sense that there's a huge push for sustainability.
Yeah.
There's a huge push that after the program ends, that whatever you have started continues. And therefore there is a really big push for private sector engagement. Marsico has been taking the lead. We have a social venture fund that has to date about 18 portfolio companies. And yes, there is a need for even more funds to be going to innovations and private sector innovations. I do not have partners or funders who are expecting me to return the money. And therefore, if I take a risk on a business, I am able to, you know, help them push it further. And if it fails, that is great, as long as they capture the lessons. And therefore, it has been an interesting journey helping Marsico to, you know, convert into a more private sector focused approach. It is not easy just because of how donor, especially in institutional donors like USAID and DFID are structured. It is not easy, but I think there's a huge push in the donor community to go into sustainability, and I know we will see more of private sector engagement going forward.
In your support for Linked Get Border, which are locally grown initiatives and startups, now you've come on board, you help them, they've scaled. How now do you make them and by the larger context in Kenya, Kenyan startups globally competitive? Mm-hmm. Seeing like something like Uber Justice, but it's not Kenyan, but it's here and it's applicable here, but it's matching with our system. How now do we scale our own startups to grow even globally? Can we first have an intra-Africa? Can we now first, how do we grow them beyond our borders? prison or
I think that's a great question, because there has been a lot of, I think, push for local innovations to go regional. And we have a lot of great examples of innovations like Africa is talking that have taken the Pan-African route. And to laud them, because it is not easy. You know, people think that if it works in Kenya, it should work in Uganda and Tanzania, and it's not always that easy. And it comes from the very beginning, at the very onset, the frameworks and the models that you put in place and internal operation system that you put in place, whether they are scalable beyond international boundaries. And what we are doing to support our innovations is to ensure that we give technical assistance. We require a lot of from entrepreneurs. You know, this entrepreneur is running the day-to-day. This entrepreneur is managing, you know, huge teams of people, is dealing with the clients. And in addition to that, we want this entrepreneur to think strategically on regional growth. It requires a lot of skill. And so our approach is dual, where we provide funding, but we also provide technical assistance. And we do that in two ways, where we have an in-house team that provides business strategy support, but we also hire technical experts on behalf of our partners to ensure that they get the strategic and specialized support that they require. We are funded by Google.org, and so we have access to Google volunteers who also support our partners. And therefore, you know, coming from a recognition that, yes, we would want to push our innovations to go global, but it requires a lot of support, and being sober about, you know, the timelines that it will take for innovations to go global, and making sure that as they scale in a way that doesn't break them, but they get the support that they need to go global. But yes, we are really excited to see some of our innovators that are thinking about exploring other regional markets, and we are really supporting them, giving them the technical support that they need as they go to, especially as they go to countries where, as Marsico, we have local presence.
Another thing, how do you feel the gig economy will close the unemployment gap? Kenya, at the moment, you are around 38-40% of the youth unemployed, and what's really intriguing for me, it's not that we lack the skills.
Mm-hmm.
People have skills out here, but there's no job to match that. On the same question of the unemployment, do you feel that are we receiving jobs as youth because there's a talent skill mismatch?
Yeah.
For instance, Masiko bought a computer guy, but there's someone with IT. Is it that what this firm wants in terms of IT is different from what that guy is offering?
Yeah.
Is that leading to higher youth unemployment?
Mm-hmm.
And how now, if at all that is the case, how now do we utilize the gig economy to absorb this? Every year now, KCS is almost being, they are finishing this week or next week.
Yeah.
It will be out. Those are other people. They meet others for last year. University is the same.
Yeah.
How are we plugging this cohort into the gig economy?
You've asked several questions. So I would start with, what do I think is causing unemployment?
Okay.
I honestly think that we simply have high unemployment rates just because our economy is not growing fast enough to create these work opportunities. We are not creating enough work opportunities in the economy. And so it's not a question of, there are people, you know, there are few high-level positions where employers are struggling to get good people who are skilled people for those particular positions. But in most part, the employers that we have talked to and interviewed have said, you know, for every position, there are at least 1,000 people who are applying for it. And out of that, there are a good number of people who are qualified for it. And so they are spoiled for choice. And this is to show that there are just, you know, not enough opportunities for all the young people that we are churning every year, especially from our education system. That said, we cannot just sit. If you have competition that is this high, then young people have to upskill themselves. Young people have to bridge the gap in order to be competitive in this market. And we are looking at gig economy from a different perspective, from an online work perspective, where we are looking at gig work as, you know, these people on Upwork, on Kuhasso, on Fiverr, who are looking for opportunities that are global, where the client is probably not sitting in Kenya. That's a great opportunity to create, to tap into opportunities that are outside of our borders, right? But then there's a lot of competition, especially with India and other countries that have really gone ahead of us and have really upskilled themselves. And so from that perspective, yes, there's a skill gap. If you're trying to compete with India, especially on IT, there's a skill gap. And there aren't too many people who can do what, you know, what they're doing on IT there. But then also we have other levels of gig work, like the blue, in the blue collar jobs, right? So where all I need is a fundi, right? And there, I think there are enough skilled workers out there, but they are either not packaging themselves right, or they are not, they do not have the soft skills to yield that confidence that they are going to do the right job. And of course, there are a lot of, you know, workers who say that, you know, fundis who say they can do everything and really they cannot do everything, that are making, you know, depleting trust among clients. And so there, I think it's not even so much a technical skill issue, but it's so much there's a soft skill gap. And what platforms such as Link are doing in providing that infrastructure, they are upskilling these people. They are training these people. They are training them on how to communicate, how to price, how to, you know, get to the client's site on time, clean up on their way out, you know, and communicate with these clients so that they feel comfortable to bring them on the job. And such things are really helping with that. But that said, yeah, at least 800,000 people who are joining the labor market. And so we have to think, how do we create opportunities for them? There are less than 100,000 formal jobs that are being created, and that leaves the informal work, and that creates the opportunity for gig work. And so how we are looking at it is, with technology, then how do we expand the market for gig workers? And a great example I like giving is with Uber, because when Uber came, they first displaced taxi drivers. And so the first few jobs, we can't say they created jobs, they simply made people who are offline become online gig workers. But then over time, they have expanded the market. There are more people who are using taxis now that they that would have never used a taxi 5 years ago, right? And so they have created an opportunity for more people to join the taxi business. And that way, that's how we're looking at, you know, more of Link, more of gig platforms, more of rider apps, more of these technology that then expand the market so that we can be able to absorb even more young people. We also know that MSMEs are the greatest employers. We are saying a shopkeeper can at this point only employ one person. But if we support them, if we help them overcome the financial barriers, if we help them overcome the market access barriers through e-commerce, if we help them overcome the talent and skill barriers for the entrepreneur through training, then they can expand into an even bigger shop or even a supermarket. And instead of employing one person, they can employ 10 other people. And that's how we're going to create entry-level jobs for all these people who are joining the labor market right now.
Yeah. I like that you're mostly focusing on how we can leverage of technology and digitization to bring all these people on board, which brings me to my third question, which is on digitization.
Yeah.
What are some of the incentives we can offer to promote adoption of the gig economy?
Yeah.
Seeing things like manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
Manufacturing, they have tax incentive,
mm-hmm.
they have special economic zones.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, I don't know, power is rated
or
chini,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
How do we offer incentives? Because for, I want to assume people like this Link,
mm-hmm.
they had the idea,
mm-hmm.
they had the people who they were starting with, but maybe they were unable to scale to reach more numbers, or maybe scale out, assume they are based in Nairobi, how can they now go to Nakuru and all across Kenya? What are some of the incentives now you have to offer to foodies in Nakuru or Kisumu so that they can come to this platform and about what they are doing, because they are, oh, anyway, I work. So what the benefit of this, or what are some of these things that they can bring these people here?
That's a great question, because inclusivity has been one of the challenges that we have raised in the gig economy. And there is that danger that we are going to create even more inequality as we leave some people behind in the digital wave. You mentioned, and you can look at it from the three levels. One, there's the platform. You know, what incentives does a platform have to expand regionally, or even to become more inclusive and create more opportunities for both genders. And there are two ways. One is just a good regulatory environment, right? There's a lot of talk of, you know, how much can the government be involved in the digitization? And I think the government has done a great job to date in building the infrastructure and in supporting telecommunication and internet adoption, and you know, allowing us to be able to even access smartphones. There's a lot that has been done that has gotten us to this point, but there's much more that can, that should be done.
Yes.
Especially if we're going to expand this outside of the urban cities, because it is easy to sit and point fingers and say, you know, why aren't these technologies going to rural areas? But in rural areas, there's no internet. In rural areas, there's no power. In rural areas, the income levels are so low that most people do not have smartphones. So with you know, if that is what they're dealing with, then they will continue concentrating in urban areas. And so there's a lot that can be done, especially with infrastructure, to ensure that we are taking infrastructure to rural areas, just so that the platforms then, when they go, then they have a good base to start on. When it comes to clients, I think we have seen in Kenya, you know, we are market leaders when it comes to adoption of digital solutions. But that said, there is much more that can be done from the client side. I know, you know, one of the census questions that they were asking is, have you purchased anything on an e-commerce platform in the last 3 months? And that's a very important thing, because that shows, as much as you have a smartphone and you have internet, there are people who still haven't overcome that digital trust or mistrust, and are not utilizing the, are not, you know, being the market for these digital solutions. And there's a lot that can be done by, especially by platforms, to create that trust, to ensure that they deliver on exactly what they say. When I buy something on Jumia and it looks like this, when it comes to me, it needs to look exactly how it looked on on that platform, because that's how we are building digital trust. And you know, and a lot that can be done with regards to lowering the cost of internet, because I know that is a huge barrier. As much as most people have smartphones, a lot of people turn on some days, and some they're not able to sustain having their data on throughout the day and every day, and so that could also go a long way to getting more people to utilize digital solutions. When it comes to workers, and I think that is the easiest of them, because workers just want work, right? If you are a carpenter, all you want is work. So if I tell you that you will get work if you go on an online platform, they will do just that, because they are seeing the value of that, right? But then there's the downside of, will the incomes that they're getting on these platforms, minus the transaction fees, still be worthwhile for them? And that is something that, you know, the platforms need to balance off in order to make sure that the workers are protected and they're getting more value by being on the platform than they would have gotten if they were off the platform. But I think a lot of good work has gone into that, and we are seeing, you know, even from our experience working with these platforms, you know, they have a lot of demand from workers who want to go on the platform, and that has not been a big barrier. Now, what we need to balance off is getting more clients, you know, getting access to the services and products on the online platform, so that they can balance off the two sides.
I like your approach to the one you've touched on, inclusivity. How do we ensure, as we digitize, we are not leaving some people behind? First answer that one. How do we ensure now we are not leaving? Because what I'm seeing, I've used Uber, let's say for the, I can give you my statistics for this year. I've never been carried by a woman. Uber driver, I've used Boda, I've not met a woman Uber driver. I've used e-commerce. I don't know about the bad side, but how do you ensure you're not living, especially gender equality, is something I'm very much also interested in. How do you ensure now, as we digitize, we are being inclusive, we are not leaving people behind, as you said? What do you think are some of the steps you need to take? And I think this has to come from the development of the platform. Our platform welcoming everyone, or are they more biased towards one gender? What's your opinion on that?
I think the challenge has actually been that as Kenyans, as Africans, that we still, how we choose the jobs we do are still very determined by gender, right? It is very rare to find a woman fundi or a woman carpenter, right? And you were seeing a lot of women are in the domestic and cleaning work. And so it is not about the platforms being biased. It's about if I do an open call right now and I say I want fundis, most likely it's only men who will come, right? And so if from the training bit, from the colleges, from the polytechnics, from the universities, we are not training women on this technical, then you know, even in the job market there will be none, right? That said, there's a lot more that can be done by these platforms to ensure that we are encouraging women, especially the women who are making career decisions now, to first know that they will not be discriminated, that there will be opportunities for them, and there will be a safe environment for them to work. So it is, you know, if I, for example, want to be a plumber and I'm a woman, if I know that I will be given the support and the tools that I need in order to do the work safely, then I'm more likely to make that decision to go and do plumbing when I'm choosing which career path to go to. What this has translated to is when we look now at the incomes. So what we did in our report, we were trying to see how much income is generated by gig workers on these platforms. And so when we did that comparison by gender, women are making the smallest fraction from this gig economy. And the reason is because women are increasingly choosing low skill, low income jobs. Women are increasingly finding themselves going into cleaning and care, which compared to even being a plumber is a low skill job. So maybe a cleaner is given for a full day's job 600 shillings. A plumber will probably make that 600 shillings in an hour. And so, you know, it's something that is coming from, you know, much more than the platform, where we just need to encourage more women to, and knowing that some of the jobs will be taken over with automation, we need to help our young people who are making career decisions now to make the right choices, to choose more of jobs that are high value, to choose more of jobs that are going to exist in 10 years, 20 years from now, because it will be very unfortunate for them to continue investing in getting education and skill in jobs that will be phased out in a few years to come.
Okay. Still on the same issue, you talked about automation leading to job loss.
Yeah.
I was talking to my friend, he's around 28, 29, 30.
Okay.
How do we revolve around that? How do we make sure, I'm lacking God for it, how do we make sure this technology, we are not only, and we are not adopting, but we also, not on the issue of inclusive, but we also not losing too much to automation. How do we go about that?
First, I think it's too early for Kenya to be worried about this. I think digitization and automation is going to lead to job losses. That is the plain truth. And there's nothing we can do about that because people cannot continue doing things manually.
Yes.
That can be automated and done more efficiently. And that's just where the future is going. There are jobs that existed 30 years ago that do not exist now, and we are still surviving, right? I think we are not yet there in Kenya and Africa. We'll continue seeing some of these manual jobs to continue to persist at least for another decade, for sure, just in the rate in which automation is coming to our country. That said, we still have to be smart about getting ahead of the curve and making informed decisions on our career choices. Something as simple as we all know that, you know, just learning programming is the next thing. It will be the next most sought after job. Data science will be the next most sought after job. Then the young people then need to take that initiative to ensure that they learn these skills. That it is not enough for you to go and do a 4-year degree in accounting if you do not know how to program, because it will come a point where nobody will require you to do the math manually. They just need you to be able to program a software, and the accounting itself software does all the work. And so that informs, you know, where our TVETs, where our colleges need to go in terms of training, but also because our education system will not evolve fast enough for young people to know that they need to take initiative to get ahead of the curve. And there are a lot of programs out there we've supported. In addition, one of the 10 partners we have is Moringa School, which is a school that is training young people on software development. And it's something, and for most, actually most of their students are people who've gone through college, people have gone through universities, they've been trained, they've done a 4-year degree, but they know they need more in order to remain competitive in this market. And they have gone for a 5-month course in order to upskill themselves and become more competitive in the market. And there are a lot of also Google, who's our donor, also have digital training skills, training programs. And there are a lot of these programs, whether it's online, some of them are for free, that young people just need to take advantage of. And that said, there's a balance there with inclusivity, right? Because as much as we are saying, you know, people need to take the initiative to upskill themselves, we also know that there are people who are really disadvantaged. There are people who, up to this day, they do not have access to a laptop. They do not have access to that. And I think the government has done a great job taking lead with their ICT centers that they have set up in the counties, but much more needs to be done to ensure that those who have ability to go and upskill themselves are able to do so, but then those who do not have the financial or structural access to basic can go to to government-sponsored spaces and are able to upskill themselves so that they're not left too far behind.
Okay. That being said, what are some of the structural reforms you think as a country, Kenya, we should be taking to support research and innovation?
Yeah.
Because gig economy, as you have said, we are finding someone has a 4-year course in accounting, but beyond that, they can't even program, even maybe some are not familiar with computer packages.
Yeah.
Now, what are some of the structural reforms you need to take? Because I think the gig economy, for it now to be where we are thinking or we want it to be, it has to have the workers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It has to have the technical assistance. It has to have the, you know, it's a whole ecosystem, and the ecosystem requires everyone to play their part. What are some of the structural reforms do we take now to support this?
So from structure, just taking like from the basic definition of, we need infrastructure.
Okay.
And we need infrastructure. We need a plan to get infrastructure to the places that it needs to go. And I think that is something that needs to be taken into account even in government policies. As they make decisions, we love roads, we should get roads. But much more, we need technology to be able to go to geography, to other rural areas, and to be widespread. I need to be able to know I can get affordable internet from anywhere. I need to be able to have access to electricity from anywhere. And that, as a bare minimum, will set us up for success as innovators in this continent. The next and most important one is our education. And I think a lot has been said about all the education reforms that we need to have, and government has done a great job trying to change that from a primary level. But even in our tertiary level, we need to see much more. And I think it's mostly even the students need to require much more from their institutions, because I think it's also, you know, very unfortunate for any student to have gone through school for 4 years and leave without the skills that are demanded by the market. And so for our tertiary education is more of understanding what the market needs and where the market is going, and preparing the students for that. And knowing that that requires a cost and an investment for them, and getting the support that they require from development agencies and government in order to ensure that every young person who leaves the education system is well equipped to for the future of work.
Okay. On my final question on digitization, as I've told you, my friend was worried about this digitization thing.
Yes.
Seeing that my Uber driver here, they lack something we call like a minimum wage.
Yeah.
Minimum wage, you find in a government institution or informal, there's what we call minimum wage. Do we have that in gig economy?
Yeah.
Do we have social protection in gig economy? And in terms of, you talked about incomes, how do we ensure now these people are getting more value in this gig economy than they were doing before?
Yeah. It is hard to do some of these reforms in the gig economy. So the answer to your question is no. We do not have social protection. We do not have minimum wage requirements. We do not have any dispute resolution mechanisms in the gig economy.
Okay.
And that is that. There's a lot of, from other markets, push to regulate the gig economy, and to put social protection measures and to put, minimum wage measures and all that. It is difficult in the gig economy, because the whole point of the gig economy is that it's independent work. You work when you want, you work where you want. And so if I can sit and put a minimum and say, at a minimum, we need you to get 13,000 every month, but what if I choose not to work? Then who gets the pull for that, right? And then there's also that balance with the market, right? I can get a carpenter to do a piece of furniture that I want at 5,000 shillings independently, not on a platform. If I am going to get to go to a platform to get the services of a carpenter, then the variance cannot be so high, right? And so the moment we say they have to put in place social protection measures, that comes at a cost. So will that cost be passed on to the client? Is the client willing to pay a premium in order to ensure that their social protection issues have been taken care of? So it's not an easy topic. The government has been, having task forces to think around these issues, and mostly they're thinking about how do we actually tax gig workers and digital workers. But I think there needs to be a more robust conversation about how to make the model work, how to make the model sustainable while still making sure that the workers are protected. That said, we have seen a lot of good results from the platform. If we do a comparison of how much the workers on these platforms are earning versus how much the workers are earning were earning cumulatively offline, we are seeing an improvement. And this is because with the platform, what I'm doing is I'm aggregating work. So if I am, for example, a plumber, and I am able, I have a poster on a tree somewhere saying for plumbing services, call this number. And, 10 times a month, I'm able to get a plumbing job on this platform, then I'll probably be able to get 20 jobs in that month. And for that reason only, they're able to get better incomes. Whether we can translate that into minimum wage or call that a minimum wage for that task, it has not yet been done. What has been done in other countries is just saying like the minimum wage for a particular task, and then you'd have to do it per task and per hour, so that as these platforms are pricing the work, or even as individual gig workers are pricing the work, they know they have a guidance system. So as much as the client would want to bargain, they know that you know we can't go beyond this. And it's a difficult conversation. We as a development organization have been taking lead in sitting in those forums to make sure that all sides are heard, and especially the worker side is heard, so that we do not have situations like we've had in some platforms in the Western world, where they're really pushing the prices down and really hurting the worker.
Because from my own experience, I've done, have you heard of online writing?
Yes.
Yes, like I've done that. And what I used to see, you usually have like a base price for a particular, what you are saying, about per task. A task is so quantifiable to a minimum, minimalist you can do. And then that minimalist is quantified and then it's priced.
Yeah.
Can we see like the same, how now do we go about the same for like now Uber, how now can we go to that? You reduce this all to the smallest unit it can go.
Yeah.
Then from this smallest unit, we can price. Then if at all someone does a big, we can now quantify according to this small units,
yeah.
Then the price, then we can say 200, like this.
Yeah.
How do we go about, do you think it's difficult with digitization to do that?
I think just the, because it's, we are talking about a large number of different tasks. It's not one task. We're not saying just driving, or we're not saying just cleaning or just plumbing. We are talking about very... So it's going to be difficult, not impossible. Not impossible. But it's going to require a lot of people to come to the table. And not just the government setting a price, but the platforms and the clients to be on the table and the workers to be on the table. Because one of the things that we have seen, even the biggest challenge we've seen with Uber and transport services is taking into consideration that it's not just the income, right? So you can do the base income, but I have also other expenses, right? There are other expenses. I am servicing a loan, or I am also getting the maintaining the car and fuel costs and all that. So you cannot simply say that because you're paying me 200 or 200 per hour, and it is aligning to whatever would be minimum wage, you cannot fail to account that I am using. And of course, and even for something like even a plumber, there's also the cost they're coming, they're buying the tools themselves, they are using their own transport to get to the client site. So there are a lot of factors that need to be taken into account, and there's no simple solution, but it's definitely a conversation that needs to be had, because we have seen, especially with online writing, that it's easy to go to a race to a bottom, where now workers start undercutting each other. So maybe the first worker quoted 500 shillings for this job, the other one just quotes 400 shillings just so that they can get the job. So it is easy to go to a race to the bottom. But we are, you know, trying to counter to say, yes, there is need for having a conversation. So there is a bare minimum, and workers do not undercut each other while making the models sustainable. That said, there's also, you know, we are really advocating for, I'd say, a career path, right? Where gig work should be supplementing your other work. And most of the workers that we talked to, you know, we talked about their aspirations. And whether it's an aspiration to become entrepreneurs, where we are seeing an Uber driver wants to own their own car, and so they take more of the cut of the pie, and they don't have to pay, you know, the car and all that, or whether it's taking this to supplement the other formal jobs, or taking gig work to supplement or as a pathway to become, you know, better entrepreneurs. But there is need for that talk of what is the career path, because how gig work has been built today is getting you an entry level job, right? It might not be sustainable for you to continue being in the gig work forever.
Okay.
And so you, there needs to be a career pathway of upskilling people where you do, maybe you start in as a low level plumber, you know, charging minimum cost for that particular task, but can you be upgraded to a master plumber because you have done X number of jobs and you have a lot of experience where I'd be willing to pay a premium for you to give you a more complicated job. And so there are needs to, and the path and the platforms are a great opportunity for that, creating that pathway that people are able to lift themselves from just making minimum wage into making more meaningful income.
And in that case, if you are promoting a career path, what I used to see in the writing is that there's that beginner,
yeah,
and your price is lower.
Yeah.
But as you go and you go, you've done like 1,000 projects, mm-hmm, your pay is higher, your premium.
Yeah.
How now do we introduce? Do we go the rating way?
Yes.
Like if you've done my work, I'll give you a 5-star. If you want to go 3-star, is that the way to go? And if that's the way to go, what are other ways we can include so that you can see the progress of this? He has come to my, the plumber came today to Masipal. Is that Safaricom? Is that Toyota? How now do we incorporate those? Is it something to do with customer feedback? How do you incorporate that into this platform so that now these people can get that career path, as you're saying?
And Link, when they started, they used to say their slogan was LinkedIn for the linked out.
Okay.
Which is creating that digital CV, creating that digital information that shows this is what the customer feedback, the clients have said about me, and using that, getting better prices. And they've done a great job at that, where, you know, people who are come highly rated and have a lot of positive feedback from clients are able to get better rates. And we are taking to see, we're seeing this as a balance. There's a pros and cons of rating system.
Okay.
So first, great for pathways. It means, you know, as I become a more experienced technician, then I'm able to charge more. The downside is, what happens to this person who's just joined straight from school? They don't have a rating.
Okay.
Does it mean they will never get a job? Does it mean, because we are very experience-based job market. Even when you see people, even in the formal market, people say, I want somebody and I want them to have 10 years experience. Because we are very experience-based market. We do not, maybe to some extent, trust that you have been educated enough in theory that you would know how to do it. We want to know that you have done it practically in the past. And so it's creating that balance for, yes, rating and get more jobs. The people who've done a good job should get more jobs, but also creating an opportunity not done a job to be able to get into the job market. And I think as we see more people embracing to become platforms, then there'll be somebody who will say, you know, I do not mind getting an inexperienced technician to come and do this job. And then there'll be others saying, like, this is too important to me. I have invested too much in this. I want to get the master at this, and I'm willing to pay a premium for it.
Okay. On our final part of the interview, it's about the future.
Yeah.
Okay. What are some of the emerging opportunities? Mm-hmm. Seeing that you've been here for 2 years at the Impact Lab, what are some of the emerging opportunity you are seeing Kenya youth and players in the gig economy can partake to grow their gig, their participation in the gig economy? What are some of those opportunities you are seeing from where you sit?
The gig economy is a great solution for youth unemployment in Kenya, for the context that we have, especially because ideally we would want everybody to get a formal job, but we are not creating enough formal jobs. And so gig jobs and breaking those jobs into ways, you know, where we can get more people to contribute and do the things that they love, when they want, where they want, independently from the comfort of their home. And also, as we are getting more millennials joining the job market who cherish that flexibility and independence, we are seeing that increasingly our gig economy is becoming a solution to youth unemployment. So we think the future is going to be bright for the gig economy. That coupled with increased technology adoption, increased use of smartphones, increased digital trust, and we are seeing more clients and corporates, you know, willing to buy services online. We know, we are projecting that the gig economy will grow exponentially. It will grow at least faster than informal work opportunities have grown. Our call to action is then now coming back to the founders, because we know that there are a lot of solutions out there and tech platforms that are helping to organize gig workers, so that there's a one-stop shop where I can get the service I need. One-stop shop where I know I'm getting that infrastructure and easy payment, easy access to workers. So call to funders to support more of those platforms. Call to funders to be at the forefront to give the initial early stage patient capital that they need in order to grow. There's also a very strong call to platforms to become more inclusive. The gig economy has been plagued by all the bad news that we've gotten about Uber and worker strikes, which is plaguing the direction in which gig economy is going. And so a call for platforms to be more inclusive, to think about their workers, to put their workers at the core and at the forefront to ensure that the workers are protected. And again, also a call to policymakers to ensure that the policies that they are making do not stifle this economy as it grows, as it's taking off. And the policies that are being made, that they are not just handed down and imposed on the players, but increasingly that they are brought to the table to give their perspective, so that as we are regulating, we protect both the platforms and we protect the workers, and we ensure that the government also is able to get some income out of it.
Finally, where do you see the Kenyan gigs in the next 3 years? That's maybe 2022, 2023.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see us now? Now that I like that your organization has supported too.
Yeah.
Are you seeing like more will come? Will we get more innovative? Will we be solving more of our problem technologically? Where do you see us in the next 3 years?
Absolutely. The trajectory with which Kenya took on technology adoption and digitization meant that it will come with it a lot of technology solutions to our everyday problems. So yes, I expect a lot of new innovations to mushroom. I expect the market to even grow even bigger as more people are willing to get jobs online. And with the advent of millennials, I expect more young people will be mindfully and deliberately choosing to be gig workers as opposed to formal workers, and that will push the growth of the gig economy even further.
Okay, I think that is all for our interview today.
Thank you very much.
You've been an amazing guest.
Asante.